This is me. As Richard said, my name's Rob Lucas. I'm Director of Operations for Field Studies Council. And I've been doing that job for about 8 years now. Before that, I was head of one of our centres in the Lake District. And before that, I was an assistant ed and a tutor and a senior tutor. So I've done lots of the roles within the organisation. And what I wanted to do this morning was to take you through the 65 years of FSC's history and how approaches to environmental discovery, environmental understanding have changed during that time. And as we go through that journey, then what we'll try and do is find out where you feel you are within your country. You might be further ahead of us. You might be somewhere along the journey that we've been making. And we'll try and share that during the morning. As we go through this journey, we're also going to do a small number of activities and investigations, including going outside, as Richard said, but we'll do that after coffee. We're only going to go into the grounds here, not very far. But from my point of view, 3 hours is a long time to sit in here listening to me talking. So it will be good to do something. That's what we believe. You have a pack which only shows you the pictures and not what I'm going to say. Because you all have quite different backgrounds. And from people doing research to people who are teaching in schools. And you speak different languages to me. So there's no point me writing down something in English, which you then have to translate what that means for you in your own language. You might as well just write down what it is you think it means in your own language to start with. Okay, so you have a space and you can make some notes if you want. Okay, now, I started off with this picture of Charles Darwin because I suppose this is where you start logically if you're thinking about biodiversity and an understanding of biodiversity. I suppose I could have put a picture up of Wallace, his the person who he also worked with on the idea of the origin of species. Darwin was very interesting as a character, and you will find out more about Darwin tomorrow morning when you actually find out much more about his history. But Darwin actually started the process of observing the natural environment in a way that we still do today, really. So he hasn't really changed very much. What Darwin started doing was he started off with observation and recording of what he saw, either in sketches, his famous drawings of the finches, or because of the time, then by collecting things. So it was around this time that museums acquired massive collections of things from all around the world as people went round shooting things and catching them and stuffing them and putting them in cases and building up collections to show us something about the range of and the diversity of the flora and fauna. So he started that process. The thing that Darwin took further than the others at the time is he actually started to analyze what he found. So when he came back from his 5 years on the Beagle on his journey, he came back and looked at his records and began to analyze them, and he began to pick out patterns, and he began to think of ways in which you could explain the patterns of data that he'd found. And from that, he came out with some conclusions. And that process, except we don't really do collection anymore, but that process of observation, recording, analysis, conclusions, is something which we still do today. It's the basis of a lot of the field studies and investigation of the environment that we do today. I guess the difference with Charles Darwin was that his conclusions were a little more dramatic and more profound than most of my students come up with. So none of my students have come up with something quite as exciting as the Origin of Species. They tend to have much more modest projects. So, but the basis of carrying out fieldwork was really established by Darwin. There are lots of different ways that you can carry out that fieldwork to go through those processes, and there are elements we can add, and we'll look at those as we go through the rest of this morning. When Darwin had been through this process and he'd come up with his idea, then what was Darwin's biggest challenge? What was Darwin's biggest problem when he had come up with his theory? He had this theory, he believed this theory was correct, but what was the big problem that Darwin had? So his idea was, first of all, quite controversial, particularly with the church, which was very powerful. He also had a problem of communication. How did he actually get this theory out now? How do you explain a complex theory to people who have no understanding of that theory at all? And that's actually the problem which all of you who teach face most of the time. Communication. You have all the knowledge, you have the understanding, you have the skills, and you have students who don't have those knowledge, don't have those skills, and you want them to take on board those knowledge and skills so that they can develop an understanding. Okay, and that's what FSC's been trying to do, because our motto, our mission, which is a terrible word, but our mission is bringing environmental understanding to all. And the key bit there, the two key, one is environmental understanding, not just environmental awareness or being in the environment. We're trying to get them to understand it. That's quite a high level skill. It's a journey to understand the environment, and we all know that actually we don't understand the environment fully, so they're only part way along their journey. We never get to the end. And the other bit is the for all. We are trying to make it an inclusive process, not an exclusive process. So we are not trying to educate a few professors, we are trying to educate a mass of people. So whatever we do, whatever approaches we use, have to be able to work across a wide range of ages and a wide range of abilities. And actually, you are quite an interesting audience. But in many ways, you are the same as many classes that you will teach, many groups that you will teach. You have some common interests. You are interested in learning about this area. You are interested in biodiversity. You are interested in education. Your students are probably interested in the football team or what was on the TV or something else, but they will have some common interests. you will have different ways, so you will have different levels of ability in your group. In this case, that level of ability is probably controlled by language rather than your actual level of ability. So it's how much you can thoroughly understand of my poor English rather than how much you are capable of understanding. If I could say it in your native language, I'm sure you'd be far more able than I am. So we've got different levels of ability in our class, and that makes it very typical as a class. Now, what way did Darwin have to communicate his message? How could Darwin communicate his message? So we're talking 150 years ago when we published The Origin of Species.
And well, there were societies where people interested in these things met and listened to each other.
Yes, they would listen to each other. Darwin would present a paper. Okay, now we're going to be doing some things on Darwin, so we have a very academic text on Darwin, which is written for, I think, 10-year-olds. So it will be perfect for this morning. Okay. What I'm going to do is, I'm not going to read you about the origin of species, because that will be quite difficult to do in the time we have. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a small piece of text from Darwin, okay? And this is basically how he had to communicate his information. It is unfamiliar to the audience, and it's also unfamiliar to you. So you're in a very similar situation to the audience that Darwin was talking about. Okay, so my name is Charles Darwin, and this is my scrapbook. You know, a scrapbook where you collect things, yeah? It's full of curious adventures and ideas. My friends call me Gas. Don't laugh, it's because I do experiments, making big explosions, bright lights, and bad smells. My brother and I have built a laboratory in the back garden. It's all our own space, and we love it. I was born in Shrewsbury, and I live just down by the river. My father is the local doctor, and we live in a big house called The Mount. I have four sisters, Caroline, Catherine, Susan, and Marion, and they don't usually like adventures. This is a picture of my mother. She died when I was 8, which makes me sad sometimes. I have one brother, Erasmus. He's older than I. He's very clever and makes me laugh a lot by putting on silly faces. I like playing outside with my friends, Garnet, Leighton, and Down. We always find places to explore. We build dens, find caves, jump in puddles, catch fish, look for bugs. My sisters laugh when I come home covered in mud. They wonder what exploits I've been up to. They'll never understand that I'm out pretending to fight crocodiles and explore new lands, just like my great hero, Humboldt. Well, there's one small bit more. I made this scrapbook back in 1821. Little did I know then that just a few years later I would be on board a ship called HMS Beagle, bound on a 5-year round-the-world voyage to explore new lands. This trip changed my life forever. I collected plants and animals and studied rocks and fossils. I kept a diary of all my exploits, just like my hero, Humboldt. When I came home, I realized I had seen and collected clues about interesting patterns in nature, birds, flowers, tortoise shells, and rocks from volcanoes. I carried out experiments for many years and worked out one big connection between these clues. My idea was that species of plants and animals sometimes change over very long periods of time from one generation to another. I named my idea the theory of evolution, and it changed the way many people thought about the world. I'm an old man now and prefer to have a quiet life with my wife and children here at Down House in Kent. I still do experiments, of course. Tomorrow, my son and I plan to collect hundreds of worms and play the bassoon to them. Even in my old age, I still have a curious mind. Curiosity is a wonderful thing. Okay, so there was a set of text, and I could imagine you're talking to your students on Monday morning, first thing, like now, first lesson, and they're thinking about the football match, and they're thinking about what was on the television, and you read out something which to them they think, what is he talking about? Why is he standing there? Okay, and that method of communication, which we use a lot, because actually when we're stood at the front, it feels nice to be communicating like that. We're in control, we're very important. It's quite easy to see what the children are doing. Stop talking, don't look, all those kind of things. But it's actually perhaps not that good at getting across knowledge. So we're going to have a little quiz to see how good it is. So I'm going to ask you some questions about the information which I've just read out to you. Okay, and if you turn over your sheet, you can write on the very back page. And we're going to have 9 questions. Okay? And Charles hasn't got to cheat and check on his computer what I've just said. Okay. So, the first question is, where did Charles build his laboratory? Yes, where did Charles build his laboratory? You can write your answers in your native language because you're going to mark them. You're not going to have to pass them round. Question number 2. How old was Charles when his mother died? So how old was Charles when his mother died? Question number 3, what was the name of his childhood house? So the name of the house where he lived when he was a child. The house in Shrewsbury where he lived. What was it called? Okay. So the name of the house in Shrewsbury where he lived as a child. Number 4, how many brothers and sisters did Charles have? You can have bonus points if you can write down the name of all of them. Question number 5. How did his brother make him laugh? So how did he make him laugh? Question number 6. Who was his great hero? Yes, who was Charles's great hero? Question number 7. How long was Charles aboard HMS Beagle? How many years? Question number 8. Name the 4 areas in nature that he collected clues about patterns. So the 4 areas that he collected data on patterns. So is what he observed. And the last question. What experiment was he about to do tomorrow? So the bit right at the end of the story said he was going to do another experiment about his curious mind. What was it going to involve? Right, now we're going to see how well we've done in our quiz. I would be amazed if you have got them all correct. I don't think I would get them all correct, and I read the text unless I wrote down the answers. And even then I discovered I'd written one down wrong. Okay, so it's not very easy. So what we're going to do is, who thinks they know the answer to number 1? Right, we'll start with Charles. Okay, Charles, what do you think the answer to number 1 is? The back of the garden. Okay. So a simple knowledge recall. Okay, you were given a fact and you've been asked to give that fact back again. The kind of thing that happens in exams, isn't it? You tell them something, they write it down again. As happens in English exams, in England. I'm sure your systems are much better than ours. Okay, how old was Charles when his mother died? 8 years old. Realise, get in quick. Do the ones you've got an answer for. 8 years old. Okay, what was his name? What was the name of the house where he lived as a child? Mount. The Mount, correct, Marie. The Mount. And you'll be going there. I think you'll probably start your tomorrow morning there. Okay. The next question is a little more complicated because you had to synthesize 2 pieces of information. Okay. How many brothers and sisters did Charles have? 1 brother, 4 sisters. So 5 in total. It's funny, isn't it? Some things very easy. So he had 5 in total. So he had 4 sisters and 1 brother. Okay. How did his brother make him laugh? Matt. Oh, go on. So go on. He moved his face. He made silly faces and silly voices. Yep. So Ursula, well done. Oh no, thanks, Matt. They've used my answer. I knew that one. Okay, I'm sure you'll get this one, Matt. Who was his great hero? Ah, you see, that's extra information, isn't it? I never told you his first name. Yeah, and Humboldt. And actually, that's interesting because it's the only name, it's the only fact that was repeated twice in the whole of the talk, is Humboldt. Yeah? It's also something which some of you would have recognized as a, oh, I know that name. I've heard of that person. You might know more about his the Humboldt Current than him as an individual, but you've kind of heard the name. So that would be a bit like you mentioning something that was on the television last night. You kind of go, oh yeah, I remember a little bit about that. I've got a bit more information somewhere. Whereas the first pieces of information were completely random. You had no, you had to listen and pay attention because you had no way, I guess, of knowing how many brothers and sisters Darwin had before we started this little talk. Just like your students have no real way of knowing what on earth it is you're going to tell them about. Okay, so next question, very easy. I suspect possibly the easiest question of all. How many years was Charles Darwin aboard the Beagle? 5 years. Yeah, he was aboard for 5 years. And again, that's something that you might have known before you came along. Question 8, more complicated, 4 different elements. Name the 4 areas in nature that he collected clues about patterns. Okay, so how are we going to do? Can we, anybody know one of them? Like to put forward one of them? Birds, animals, rocks, fossils. So birds, animals, rocks. The other one that... No, the other one was a very odd one. Something that's very famous. But tortoise shells. Remember the Galapagos tortoises? And he talked about the evolution of their shells. So there, you were actually bringing in your wider knowledge. Because you were thinking, these are the areas that I think I know that you might have done some work on as well. So some things we can make it easier for students by having questions they might have links with. The last question, what experiment was he about to do tomorrow? Playing a saxophone to worms. He was actually playing a bassoon, but bassoon is a strange word. He's playing a musical instrument to worms. Why? I'm not sure. He doesn't say why.
It's because he wanted to find out if they had hearing.
Correct. I think that's what he was trying to do. So he's trying to find out, would they respond to sound? I think it actually followed on from the observation of when worms come to the surface of the ground when it rains, and he wondered if noise was one of the triggers. So did they respond to sound or did they respond to other things? And it was the start of his curious mind. I don't think he was wondering whether they would like music, merely whether they would respond to it. Okay, so 9 questions. You've just sat your exam on Charles Darwin. Some odd facts about Charles Darwin. Okay, how many people scored 9? Richard scored 9. Did you have the book, Richard? How many people scored 8? Ooh, close. Top student. How many people scored 7? 6? 6? 6, 6, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, none. We had a distribution, and as I said at the start, that the actual main barrier from your point of view was actually language. Plus, some of you may learn in different ways. Some of you may be very good. Most of you will actually be very good at taking and retaining facts from written and spoken material, because our education systems favour those people. So in order to get all the way through the system and get to the level that you are at, you've got to be good at those skills, because if you learnt mostly by doing things, the chances are you wouldn't have ended up doing the job you're doing now. So you're a very intelligent audience. The only real barrier is language and the fact that some of the facts are really stupid. You're never going to need to know that he built a laboratory in his back garden. But there again, to most students, some of the information they are asked to learn about is also really stupid. Why do you need to know those things that we make them study? Okay, so you'll be pleased to know that each of these slides will not take as long as this one. Otherwise, we will be here for days. So from Charles Darwin, what came out after quite a gap was an acceptance of the idea of evolution, and particularly the idea of exploring the natural environment. It's a very educated view of the environment. It belonged to those people who'd been through school, been through perhaps university, and it involved a kind of culture of going out into the countryside, usually led by people like Sunday school teachers, so church groups, things like that. Because the person who was leading the group would have been through that education system, whereas most of the people in the group, they were just participants. The person who's the leader thinks it's a good thing. These people will do what they're told, basically. So they're going for a nature walk. And it started that kind of culture of going out on nature walks, where the real driver for it, the main reason for going, was to do with enjoyment, to do with health, and to do with building some kind of empathy, some kind of relationship with the environment. But it was still quite exclusive, so not many people participated. The vast majority of the people who lived in the cities and the big industrial towns didn't go out into the countryside. So although it's a kind of thing which is very important, and it's quite restricted to the groups of people who were engaged in it, so it wasn't very good for the for all part of our mission. Could have been okay for some of the understanding, but not very good for the for all. And that was emphasized by this person. This person is Francis Butler. He's not a name you will ever come across other than in the context of FSC. I'll write it up in case you want to write it. Francis Butler. Francis Butler was the founder of the Field Studies Council. Okay, so he was the founder of the Field Studies Council. It was his idea. And Francis was an inspector of schools for London during the Second World War. And he was responsible for the children who were being evacuated out of London and out into the countryside. So the children were evacuated out of London because of the bombing, and were taken out into the countryside. And he was appalled at how little the children knew about the countryside. Even basic things like they would have never seen a cow or a chicken. So really, really basic things that they wouldn't have seen. Of course, this was largely before anybody had television, or even the masses would have had papers that had illustrations in them. Okay, so he was appalled at how little they knew. And he came up with the idea of a network of centers staffed by experts, people who had local knowledge. And so on December the 10th, 1943, the Field Studies Council was created. So that's when the Field Studies Council, so we're just over 65 years old now. And this was very visionary thinking. It was part of the big, where do we go after such a terrible thing as a major war? Where do we go? So it was part of a whole series of things, like our national parks were created around this time. Most of our planning laws were created around this time. So it was a time of big thinking. People were thinking about what do we do in the future. And it was very timely that he was involved. And so we created some field centres. And if I just turn that off so you can see that a bit, I don't know whether any of you recognise this picture. It's a very famous painting by Constable. And it is supposed to be the typical English landscape. And this building, which is called Willie Lott's Cottage, is actually part of our field centre. And the other reason for showing you this picture is that although we are predominantly a sciences-based organisation, we are actually set up to promote environmental understanding through both the arts and sciences. So we have quite a broad remit. So it's both arts and sciences, not just some of the scientific things, which will obviously be the link with, immediate link with biodiversity. And I think you have, sorry, plants. Where is it located? If you look in your arts brochure, which I think you got in your pack, if you've left them behind, don't worry. I'm sure we will have some to share between. And if you haven't got an arts brochure, then you could share your other one because it will also have a map. So it's the one that looks like this. One says Arts 2009, one says Natural History 2009. If somebody wants to look at a Natural History one, if you haven't got yours to hand, it's got a map inside on page 4. I think it's on page 4, whichever brochure you happen to have. And this centre, which actually also involves the old mill buildings, is at Flatford Mill, which is FM on the map. It is the one furthest to the east. You've tracked it down? Yeah. Okay, we are actually... That's where the centre is. And that's the picture. So that centre, that picture is part of the centre. So students sleep in the cottage, in Willie Lott's cottage. And the other part of the centre is the mill here, which is almost from where the picture was taken of, or the painting was done.
But the painting is also in the house.
Oh, where is the painting? Oh, the painting. The painting is in the National Museum. Yes. It's worth about £20 million. Yes, not on our wall, no. It would be nice if we had it. In London, yes. National Gallery, sorry, National Gallery. Yeah, the arts one. Do you know where you are on that map? PM, yes, we're at Preston Montford. So we're right on the western side of England because about 5-10 kilometers further west of here, we go into Wales, which is kind of a separate country-ish, sort of a principality. Okay, so that helps you orientate yourself a little bit. So we started to create field centers. And from these field centers, what we did is we went out and told people about the environment. And I put this picture in because this person is Ian Mercer, who is our president. And he was one of our first field tutors. And 50 years on, he still can't stop telling people about the environment. This is his wife who is learning all about the environment in this particular instance. But actually, he's pointing out the landscape. And when we were actually created, we had very, very few resources. So most of the things that we did were about interpreting the landscape. Okay, so we would go out and you would draw the landscape. You would then look at it and try and explain it and think about it. You might go and look at another bit in more detail. But we had very little equipment to do some of the things we would do now. You wouldn't pull up the picture on Google Earth to have a look at it. Okay, so very, very limited resources. The other thing which we were doing is we structured our biology work around ecosystems. Now today, that seems very normal. But actually, when we started doing it, nobody looked at ecosystems. In fact, one of our founders, Arthur Tansley, kind of came up with the idea of the coin, the kind of phrase within England, I'm sure others may have done the same within your language, of ecosystems. But at this time, if university groups came, universities looked at organisms. They came and looked at individual organisms or several organisms. They collected them. They put them in jars or they put them in books. But and they noted in great detail what they were and how to identify them. So they became very good at taxonomy. They were very good at identifying things, but they didn't look and think, how does this species relate to this species in the habitat that it lives in? So we introduced really the idea of fieldwork based on ecosystems. And that idea continues today and is still applied in lots of places. These are actually forest workers, people from the Forest Service in Taiwan that we were running a course for, and they were looking at an ecosystem, in this case an ecosystem within the kind of grounds of the Royal Palace. They were also, interestingly, quite keen on collecting. It's quite a natural thing. I think lots of people who are very good naturalists now say that they actually started off collecting things. They collected things like birds' eggs. They collected things like butterflies. Now, that's become much less politically correct to collect things these days. But we've become almost, difficult words, surrogate protect collectors. We don't actually collect them and stick them in a book. We now have a list, don't we? Bird spotters have lists. They go around and they tick when they've seen the species. People have flower books and they go around and they make notes where they've seen them. So We still collect, we just don't actually pick the things up and take them away with us now. We just collect the information about where we saw them. But interestingly, these people never really done this before. They'd had no instructions, and the first thing they did was started collecting. So there is a kind of natural, and that's actually quite a close engagement, isn't it? I mean, as an ecological and educational experience, then collecting them from the education point of view is probably very good. They've engaged with that environment. They've collected it. They've thought about the fact that it's important. Unfortunately, it's sometimes not very good for the environment. Now here, it doesn't really make much difference. This is a piece of of grass, which is basically a lawn. So somebody's coming along with their lawnmower every couple of days. So the fact that they're going to pick a few things out of it is not going to make much difference. The problem is we tend to collect the interesting things, and they tend to be the rare things. And there is the problem, especially if you have lots of people doing fieldwork. So in a typical year, we will have about 5,000 students coming here doing field courses. Across the organization, we have about 100,000 people coming along doing field courses. If everybody collected, we would soon be looking at a sea of mud and water with no animals in. So we don't really collect anymore. As the organization grew, we acquired more centers. And the centers at that time tended to be bigger. And where possible, we got them with some land. So this is a slightly fuzzy picture. This is our center at Orielton, which is a lovely building. And we bought this building and the land for a very small sum of money, because nobody really knew what to do with big houses that took a lot of looking after. Okay. I think we bought this in the 1960s, and we paid around, well, straight exchange rate now, isn't it? We paid about 20,000 euros. Okay. And that includes 40 hectares of land, the building, and the big courtyard, which is, you can only see, oh, here's the cottage. The courtyard is here in the trees, the stable yard where all the workrooms are. And we can take about 130 students staying in the center, because nobody wanted these buildings. They were very expensive to look after. They were too big for family houses. And so we got them very cheaply. This building was built in about, it was extended in about 1780. Yeah, so that's when it was restyled. We've just done a lot of work on this building. It used to be half as long again. It used to come to here, but it had a fire about 100 years ago. And so they knocked down this end and built a new end wall for it. We built some new bathrooms here, this bit here. So it used to be a much bigger building. It has also been changed a lot through history. So it's been made to look very Georgian, but actually there are parts of it which are older than that. So it was a typical field centre, quite large, good location in terms of access to sites, bad location in terms of access to people. So this is in West Wales. And so it takes about 5 hours to get from London to this centre. So it's quite remote. But people used to come for 1 week. They used to come for 7 nights. So it was okay to spend pretty much the whole day travelling there and pretty much the whole day travelling back again. Now, the average length of stay of students in our centre is only 3 nights. So people are now saying, is it a good idea to travel for 5 hours to go to a place where you only stay for 3 nights? And over time, the length of courses has got shorter and shorter. That also puts pressure on how we have to teach, because in general, the knowledge they want, the content the people want when they come, is still the same. They just want it in a shorter period of time. Okay, so things have got squeezed. Some things have helped us with that, but it has still put pressure on. When I first started, every group I taught came for 7 days. We developed a course which matched what the students needed for their exams, but also for our environmental understanding. And it was very predictable. Okay, quite boring, really, but actually very predictable. So I knew from where I was standing. So if I was standing on the coast, I would know it was Saturday. I would be on the coast, it will be Saturday, it will be coastal geomorphology, and I could probably tell you what I had in my lunchbox. Life was very predictable. And then on Sunday, I was on the Shingle Ridge ecosystem. On Friday, I was in the woods doing hydrology. On Thursday, I was on Dartmoor doing rivers. I knew it was very simple. There was one program, everybody came along, everybody thought it was okay. Time was much less pressured. People came along because they thought it was a good course. There was nothing in the curriculum that said you had to do fieldwork. People did fieldwork, people went outdoors because they thought it helped the students understand the subject. Quite often, it was because the teachers themselves had been on field courses and been outdoors when they were students. So it was a kind of positive feedback loop. They had the experience. Some of them went on to become teachers. They valued the experience, so they then took other people outside. But there was nothing in the curriculum that said you had to go and do it. When we acquired these centres, the other thing we did is we started pulling in more data. We started measuring things a lot more, and things became much more accessible. You know, from the start of things like weather stations. Most of our field centres have had weather stations since they were set up. But we also started collecting runs of data, records of data. We started being able to do things like getting satellite weather maps and so on. And in fact, I remember in 1979, we had our first computer training course for our teaching staff. And we had computers in all our centres in 1979 to help with the processing of information. Because we were spending more and more time collecting data. So we were very much in a data collection phase. And that's almost the second phase of field studies. We started off very much with observation, and then we moved into data collection. And that kind of fed on itself, because we actually, now obviously you can use things like Excel to process data, but there were no spreadsheets when we started this off. So our computer training course was to teach us how to write computer program to learn how to analyze field data. So we would write computer, you know, that would allow you to put in a set of data from students and do calculations on that data. So it was very, very basic things. Now, of course, it's very easy, and the students know far more about it than we do. And so now there was no limit to how much data we could collect. Because we had an easy way to analyze information, you could collect masses of data and then analyze it quite quickly. And because of that, you then start and develop other things. you start and develop abundance scales so that you can process data more quickly. Instead of working out percentage data, what percent of this square is occupied by that leaf? Well, leaves, that one and that one. I don't know. What would you think? How many percent?
Twenty-five percent
of that one square, maybe. And that square is how many big squares? 1, 2, 3, 4. So each square is 4%. So maybe 1% plus this little bit here. Yeah? And the problem with percentage data is students are rubbish at estimating it. In fact, we're all pretty rubbish at estimating it. And in fact, if we didn't have the strings on, you would have found that really, really hard. Okay, so you might use the logic of it's 1/4 of one of those squares, and how many squares are there? That's a level of skill that students rarely seem to get to. They just look at it and go, let's have a guess. Okay, so we develop other systems like the ACFOR scale, the abundant, common, frequent, occasional, rare, which also is trying to do something ecologically, isn't it? Because it's actually saying the difference between, say, something having 5% cover and 10% cover is more important than the difference between having 70% cover and 75% cover. One of them's twice as much, the other one's just a little bit more. So we developed these scales, which also allowed us then to process more data, process it more quickly. So we've got masses and masses of data, most of which is never pulled together, but basically we have masses and masses of data. The other problem that we also have then is it's all very well looking at what's in the quadrat and recording, but you've somehow got to be able to identify it. And here we ran into one of our major problems, and that is that the taxonomic skills of people, students, are going down very quickly. Most people who can identify things out in the field to a good level are more than 50 years old. There are very few young biological recorders. You're going to meet a younger one later. I was thinking, what day is Pete coming over? Is Pete involved?
Yes.
Thursday, yeah. On Thursday, you'll see Pete, our biodiversity project officer. He's one of those rare people who's not close to retirement who can actually identify something. And this is a big concern for us. We had, so we developed originally what were called the aid gap keys, which is an acronym which stands for the aid to identification of difficult groups of animals and plants. So that's what aid gap means. Those were designed for university students and A-level students. So they were designed to be quite a high-level key. We then developed these things, fold-out charts. I think you have one in your pack. I'll give you another one, because I know people love collecting charts. So that's the brochure that tells you about all of them, but it's always fun if you get free gifts. Here we are, you can have another one. I think that's a different one, is it? So you've got, which one have you got? Bugs on bushes? Oh, yes. And if there are things that you want from the publications, if you let Richard know by Thursday, because if they don't have them at the centre, our publications unit is just down the road and they can make sure they can get them here for you for Friday. Okay. Now, these charts are designed, or were originally designed, for primary school children. So they were for young children who couldn't use the AGAP keys. And you can see some of the range of them on the back wall. So things like butterflies, bats. What else have we got? We've got animal tracks, reptiles, fossils, dragonflies and damselflies, butterflies. So a whole range of them. And what you now find are that university students use these for identification. So that's how quickly the taxonomic ability has gone down. I think we now only have 3 botany courses in the whole of the British Isles. There's only 3 university botany courses. So we have this wonderful thing. Everybody talks about biodiversity. It's terribly important we conserve it, and nobody can identify it. So that started one of our campaigns when we really, first time we got into campaigning. We're not really a campaigning organization, but thank you. So we started this campaign, which was kind of became Save Our Biology. And it was about teaching outside the classroom. Was it heading for extinction? Okay, so you can follow the Darwin link. Okay, and we're not going to go through the report in detail, other than to say that it did find some favour with politicians and with the people who were writing the curriculum. And so there were, over a period of time, some changes to the national curriculum. Now, this afternoon, Andy Simpson's going to tell you much more about how that system works in the UK. But just to prove it, because I know Andy's not going to use this one, then this is the big picture of our curriculum now. And for the first time, thank you, for the first time ever, if you look at the green section, number 2, and look across the top row, you can see written large, learning outside the classroom. And that's the first time it's ever appeared in our national curriculum. Okay, so there is actually a commitment for people to go outside the classroom to learn. He doesn't say what, and it doesn't say how that has to happen, partly because at the positive end, you could actually do that across a whole range of subjects. It doesn't just have to be geography or biology, although that's where most of the trips to the environment are. It could be art. That would be good to get people out there observing. The negative view is it doesn't give any more detail, because if you said exactly how it had to be done, you would have created an entitlement which people would have argued the government should pay for. So by not being specific about what it is, it also means they avoid paying for it, so people have to pay for it themselves. But there are lots of people going outside the classroom. There are an estimated 7 million out-of-classroom visits take place each year in the UK. There are 8 million children, roughly, in education. I think probably only about half the children actually get an experience of any sort, because some people get lots of experiences. So it's not evenly, it's not that 1 million get no experience. I think maybe 4 million get no experience, and some get lots of goes because their school thinks it's a good idea. But that's the kind of overall structure of our national curriculum. And I printed it in colour, or Richard printed it in colour for me, because it's very hard to read in black and white. But that kind of changed how we went about things. Okay, so it started this recording, sorry, that was the last of the things. That recording bit was K carrying on doing recording. Okay, that was just say, and that recording bit now happens, and this, some more people in Taiwan, I think this was the following year, different bit of the Royal Palace doing some different sorts of recording. Okay, and so you get the kind of worksheet which is designed to then imagine, you can imagine your Excel spreadsheet that they're just going to type the numbers in. So we're kind of matching the information with how we're going to process it. So eventually you get to a situation where what determines what you collect is how you're going to process it, not what's important to collect in the first place, which gets you into an interesting kind of question. So what we're going to do now is have a coffee break, because it's hard work listening to me for over an hour. Chronology, in terms of date and time, then we started off doing our interpretation of the landscape, the looking and seeing, in the 1950s. In the 1960s and 70s, we increased the amount of measurement that we were doing. So we entered that measurements phase, which is still with us, and we still do lots and lots of measurement. In the 1980s, we started to enter another phase of our fieldwork. And that was particularly in geography. And it was because we started to get a thing called issues-based geography. It was one geography curriculum. So as Andy will probably explain, at advanced level, there are different exam boards that produce specifications. Yeah. And the schools can pick whichever one they want. One of those was called the London Exam Board. It now has a totally different name because it's been through many kind of combinations. It's now owned by Pearson's, who are the international publishers. And it produced a thing called 16 to 19 issues geography. And that changed what we were doing. And it has become the most popular A-level geography exam. So most students take that exam. It finished this year. We have a new national curriculum now, a new specification, which contains many of the elements though. The difference now compared to previously is that previously what we would be doing is we would be trying to explain the natural environment. So we might be trying to explain about food chains, or we might be trying to explain about succession of plants, or we might be trying to explain why the landscape looks like it does as a result of glaciation or something like that. Okay, what happened with issues-based geography is it changed the focus. So now what we're looking at is these students who are still recording plants are actually recording it across a footpath and are looking at the interaction between people and the environment. Okay, in some cases that is looking at the impact we have on the environment. In some parts of that curriculum, it's actually looking at the way the environment has impacts on people, but it's kind of looking at that interrelationship. And that means it becomes much more about values. So people at the end of this investigation, they don't end up with a, yes, we now understand the ideas of plant succession. What they end up with here is they have a record that they can show that says the impact of this footpath is whatever it is, changing vegetation or compaction of soil or increased runoff of water. And what does that mean? How do we manage that? Do we manage the people? Do we manage the environment? Do we let the environment continue to change? So it introduces a whole set of values and attitudes to the curriculum. Now, when this new curriculum came in, it had a big problem because it was all about values and attitudes, but the students had no factual knowledge on which to base their values. So they would come along and go, they would look at this, or they would look at the management of a river channel, as an example, but they would have no understanding of how rivers worked, only that they could see that we'd change that river. So we used to have we developed the first courses for this. I think we ran the first teacher's course in South Devon. I think I was a very young tutor. It was about 1981, I think, we ran the pilot course with the 12 schools that piloted this in the UK with the Institute of Education in London. And it used to be called 16-19 Geography, and the joke used to be that 16 to 19 was the number of pieces of paper you have to have, because you talk to the students and then you discover they didn't know anything, so you give them a piece of paper with some more information on, and then you talk to them a bit more and you discover they don't know something else and you give them some more paper. So it used to be the joke about how many pieces of paper you used to end up with to do any investigation. It's now got a better balance, but that idea of issues-based geography is actually one which actually features very strongly in all the new specifications. The biology has been a little slower to catch up. So it still has much of the traditional food webs, pyramids of numbers, biomass, species diversity, adaptation, which are classic things which will continue. But in the last round of curriculum review, it now includes lots of things to do with the impacts of climate change. And climate change, from our point of view, whilst it might wipe out the planet, is a wonderful educational resource. It's a great driver for people wanting to go out and look at the environment. And I was thinking when we were talking about Darwin, about kind of 15 years ago, the climate change people were almost in the same place as Darwin, weren't they? They were going, oh, we've got this idea, this is going to change. But no, that's not going to happen. That's never going to happen. And now in kind of 15 years, we've had this very big change. And it's a huge opportunity for us because it has popularized the environment. So people are interested in it. I don't know how long it will last. And I suspect that unless we have a regular occurrence of natural disasters, it will fairly quickly go out of the public eye, which is a kind of sad reflection of this media-driven society that we're in, but that's probably the reality. As long as we keep having coastlines swamped by big storms, as long as we keep having major storms, you've just had your biggest storm in 10 years in France, going through southern France, last Thursday, Friday, wasn't it? Northern Spain, wiped out, blew over, killed some children, didn't it, blew over a sports centre. 20-meter waves hitting the coast. So as long as it stays dramatic, we're okay. Lots of people want to go out and be interested in the environment. The next challenge is if you try and go from biodiversity, which is very closely linked to the environment, the natural environment, the modified environment, and all of this is modified. This is the Lake District, and all of this environment is managed. We have very, very little true natural environment. Probably our only real natural environments, apart from some places in Scotland, of any size, are probably things like salt marshes on the coast. They're probably the closest we've got to a truly natural environment with very little intervention from people. But there is a challenge because there is then a big leap from biodiversity to things like the causes of climate change. So they're thinking I'll turn off my light bulb, or I'll not leave my television on standby, or we'll do some recycling. So those are the kind of things we are promoting to them, are being promoted. But actually, it's really difficult to make that link back to, so what does that mean out there in the natural environment? They may, if you've got data from the past, you might be able to do the things of looking at, this is what this area used to be like, and now, 30 years on, we can go and measure it and say, oh, that's what it is like. So we now actually have a use for all that data that we collected 30 years ago, because it is going to be an important historical record that we can go back to and revisit and say, well, actually, when they were doing this 30 years ago, there were twice as many species here, or there were different species here. Okay, so those long-term data, which people kind of got into the, why are we collecting it? We just collect it. We never do anything with it. Suddenly, light comes on. We have a use for it. So, but that still gives us a challenge of how do you make a more direct link? And we're going to take an example. One of the things which is talked about a lot is about using bioenergy. So we will use wood-fired boilers to power our central heating. And we can just keep replanting the trees, and we can have sustainable forests, and the end product is our carbon footprint much, much better, much more sustainable. But there is no comprehension of what that actually means. Does that mean that we are going to walk out and the entire country is covered in forest? Does that mean that we need one tree for us to be able to survive for a year? Perhaps you know, some of you live in countries where wood is much more commonly used. But does anybody have the faintest idea how many trees it will take for us for a year to produce enough biomass? And Richard's an expert on this, so we'll come to Richard. Does anybody else have an idea? I don't have much of an idea. If I went outside and saw a tree, well, I know that a big branch came off a tree next to my house, and it was a big branch. It was, I couldn't get my arms around this branch, and it produced about 3 tons of timber. And that has kept me going, heating the house and not the hot water, because that's not on the same system, for about 2 years. So I have a rough idea that I can count up how many big branches there are on this tree and get a rough idea of how much there is. But if I walked around here and said, okay, what does that mean? How much, if we looked at all the trees in this area within the grounds, then what does that mean? Is that what we need to keep us going for a day, a week, a year, our lifetime? And therefore, you can start and do some simple maths and work out what kind of impact it might have on the landscape. So that's what we're going to do. A colleague of mine, Steve Tilling, he came up with a very clever idea of taking some things that were produced for forestry, which are tables of biomass. Basically, they were talking about, they used it to work out, to approximate how much timber was going to come out of a forest. And they had this wonderful archaic British unit called Hopper's Feet, after the gentleman Hopper who invented it, which basically meant an experienced forester could walk up to a tree at chest high, put their arms round it, and from that tell you how much timber was in that tree. Because the girth at this sort of height has got a very good relationship to the total quantity of timber in the tree. So Steve took that idea and then used that to work out what that would mean in terms of energy production from that. Now, there are lots of big assumptions made, as you can imagine, and lots of rounding errors to creep into these calculations, but he's been able to produce some sums to give you at least an approximate idea. Okay. Hopper. Yes, sorry. Now the hopper's feet, it's not those feet, it's for you it would be hopper's meters. Yes, it was a measurement of distance, yes. And it actually it measured in the original calculation, it calculated it in cubic feet of timber, so it's been converted into metric and then converted into but that's where it that's where the idea came from. And it proved to be within the forestry remarkably accurate. So experienced foresters could walk into forests, kind of go around, sample a few trees, and then say, there's 20,000 tons of timber going to come out of this. And they would be, you know, within kind of 10%. So it was actually a pretty accurate means of doing it. And we've just taken that and made it a bit more scientific. Now, clearly, it would take a long time for us to learn all the sums. So what I have for you is a calculations sheet and a conversion sheet. Well, it's kind of a conversion sheet, the calculations bit you get to do.
So tree hoppers is actually
a scientist. Yeah, much better than just the kind of, the nasty kind of, not the, the kind of connotation of tree huggers, who are very passionate about the environment, but perhaps not so knowledgeable. So you can see down here, you have the girth of the tree on the first column A. In column B is the calculation as to what the volume of the tree will be. That's the kind of hopper's feet bit metric. Then there's a calculation of what that means in terms of mass, and that's based on the dry weight of timber, because in most cases you'll be drying the timber. And then a calculation of energy content, and then a calculation for how many people that would provide heating and hot water for. So it doesn't attempt to calculate electricity from power stations, because what it's assuming is that you've got relatively little transmission loss. So you've got a boiler here and you're heating it up locally, not you've got a wood-fired power station somewhere a long way away, and then you've got to calculate transmission losses and things. So it's a very, very simple set of calculations. So what we're going to do is we're going to go out and we're going to go to the little arboretum, which is just round the other side of the building on the other side of the courtyard. So we're not going very far. Interestingly, those trees were planted just before we started using our computers. They were planted by the person who was head of centre here, who then became the director of the Field Studies Council, a gentleman called Charles Sinker. It is a wonderful educational resource, though Charles at the time probably didn't appreciate it, because nobody was thinking about climate change and biomass and things like that. But what we actually did is we planted a whole set of different trees at the same time, and then we just let them get on and grow. So we've got a wonderful little educational resource there. We know when they were planted, so we can see in terms of time scale how long it takes to produce that amount of timber. We've also got different species of trees that were planted, though that wasn't the reason why they were planted. They were planted to provide probably sampling for something else completely different. But actually, we can now look at issues. You could talk to students about, so which sort of trees are best at producing biomass? And then you can start and link that in to other studies, like, but if we looked at their biodiversity that they support in terms of aphids and other invertebrates, it's not just such a simple calculation as that one produces the most timber, because there are other issues. There could be aesthetic issues about whether they're attractive or not. I don't actually think if we go down the kind of mass harvesting of willow, it will actually be much, you know, be pretty ugly looking countryside. If we've just got miles and miles of, you know, will it look any different from miles and miles of oilseed rape or sugar beet or whatever else is one of these mass crops? Okay, now, because one of the problems we're going to have is we won't be able to identify the trees. A, because they're not your native trees. And if you were students coming from the city, there are no native trees. Okay. And B, you have a key, but the problem is, if you held up your key, Matt, what's the problem? What are they pictures of? They are pictures of leaves. And the problem is, there are no leaves on the trees. So, I now have some pictures of winter buds.
So they are
about 30 years old. Yeah, I think about 33 years old they were actually planted. But roughly 30 years old. Okay, so now we have a resource which might help us identify some of the species. It won't identify all of them, but it might help us identify some of them. There is actually, this is a one that's for sale, I borrowed it, which is an aid gap key, so the more difficult, the more kind of higher level one for identification of broadleaf trees and shrubs in winter. And that's the kind of technical expertise of which we've just pinched some diagrams out of, basically. So this is the equivalent of the fold-out chart, because that's the kind of thing that people do. They match the pictures. Okay, so we're going to go outside. We're going to do the activity. If we work in groups of three, we can have three groups of three. And what we'll do is we'll divide the area up. We'll divide the area up. Each group needs a tape measure. So whoever you're going to work with, you need a tape measure. And what you need to do is you need to fill in the tally chart on the sheet. You need to go down and basically, in your area, you need to complete column F. Okay, so all you do is put a mark. If your tree is 35 centimeters at this height, then you just find 35 and you can find a midpoint. For this example, we will put them into the nearest category of 10 centimeters. Okay, there is a sliding scale, there is a formula behind this, and you could actually measure the numbers exactly, but given the time we have, we're just going to put them into a category. Okay, and then what we can do is when we come back is we can work out how many pupils we could support from that.